The time is now 10:01, and we will start the meeting of the District of Columbia Board of Ethics and Government Accountability. My name is Tamika Collier. I am here with Shamari Wade and Norma Hutchison. Since the last meeting, we have added a new board member, Mr. Darren Sobin, who unfortunately is out of the country and will not be attending the meeting today. But we do have three out of the four sitting board members, so we do have a quorum. I have reviewed the agenda. Are there any changes, amendments to the agenda?
No.
Hearing none, I will entertain a motion to adopt the agenda.
I move to adopt the agenda.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Ms. Hughes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. On February 8, 2018, the Board of Ethics and Government Accountability will appear before the Committee on Public Safety and the Judiciary for our annual performance hearing. Both the Office of Open Government and the Office of Government Ethics have submitted to Chairperson Collier the office's combined responses to the pre-hearing questions posed by the committee. The responses are due to Chairman Allen's office by close of business on Friday, February 5th. During the past performance hearing, the chair of BIGA has testified on behalf of both offices. Last year, the OOG testified separately. We will need the board's guidance on how you would like to proceed for this year's performance hearing, and additionally, the budget hearing.
Yes.
Additionally, Director Wolfenbarger and I met with Department of General Services personnel on Wednesday of this week to discuss BIGA's options for obtaining a larger office space to contain both OGE and OOG. The Department of General Services believes it can provide to us a cost estimate for the board to consider. However, if BIGA intends to include this with its budget request for fiscal year 19, we must inform the mayor's office of the enhancement request by Monday, February 5th.
Let me ask you, my position has been, obviously, if we move to a different building, then both offices need to move as BIGA. But I've also said, because we are not paying rent here, if OGE can get a slightly larger space or at least find room to accommodate three FTEs, then we stay here under the impression that OOG has sufficient space. Is that accurate?
Well, I hear you, but what we're being told is that DGS is saying there is no more space here at Judiciary Square.
But if we could find a slightly more space, are you satisfied with the space that you currently have? If we could find two spaces for FTEs for the new hires for OGE, are you satisfied with the space that you have?
With the space here?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But what DGS and what we've been clear is that we would just like to hear what our options are.
Right.
And then, of course, we'll inform the board.
Right. My concern is, as you noted, budget enhancements are due Monday, I believe it is. I'm not sure that that's going to work in the near future. And even if Alan, let's say we don't get the budget enhancement approved, what our options are working currently in this building. I'm not taking it off the table. I absolutely think you all should pursue it. But I've been working on the, if we can find a little larger space for OGE, we can stay. But I wanted to confirm with you that you are satisfied with the space for OOG.
Because we don't have any immediate plans to grow, I could use another attorney, but I'm not asking for another attorney because there's no place to put another attorney.
Okay.
So I'm working within my given space, and we're comfortable in this space.
Okay.
And so I guess we'll just see what DGS is going to tell us in terms of our options. Now, during our budget review team meeting, Director Wolfenbarger and I did give the mayor's budget team a heads up that we may be looking at options for a larger space. So it won't come as a complete surprise, but we recognize that it may not be workable to get in the numbers by next Monday.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. On February 26, 2018, the mayor's office convened a meeting of agency FOIA officers to announce that all agencies will now have access to FOIA Express, the online processing system for FOIA requests. The vendor AIMS will conduct 16 trainings at the Office of the Chief Technology Officer between March and December of this year.
Have you had experience with FOIA, eFOIA Express?
Yes, I'm the person who processes FOIA requests for BIGA, so I've been using the system from the beginning.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to the changes to the system. I can just say that. And I'm a techie, and I find it
I use it. I don't dense. Like it.
I find it dense. equally important is that the EOM announced it will propose amended legislation and regulations updating FOIA. There weren't many specifics supplied other than amendments to the FOIA fee structure under DCMR 1-408. I've asked Karuna Sehishai. I might always get her last name wrong. I've asked Karuna, the Open Government Officer for the Executive Office of the Mayor, if she would please consider including the OOG in discussions on the front end regarding the amendments, many of which are likely already included in the Strengthening Access to Government Transparency Amendment Act of 2017.
Do you have an update on that?
Nothing other than what Chairman Allen has said to us, that he does not anticipate moving it to committee. This might change things. I don't know. She hasn't responded, so I'm hoping that they'll involve this office. The United Medical Center opinions 0014 and 0015. On January 25, 2018, the OOG issued two opinions regarding complaints about the December 13, 2017 meeting of the United Medical Center Board, in which the board entered into a closed executive session to debate and take final action on a resolution resulting in the closing of the hospital's obstetrics unit. The OOG found that the board improperly entered into closed executive session and that the deliberation regarding the closing of the unit and the final action of approving the resolution are not matters that fall under any of the exceptions under the Open Meetings Act and therefore should have been discussed in open session. To preserve the authenticity of the debate rather than requiring the UMC board to deliberate and vote again on the resolution, the Office of Open Government required the United Medical Center Board to publish the audio recording of that portion of the closed session on the UMC website and to publish meeting-related records relied upon to reach a final vote. I'm going to continue to communicate with the council to the UMC board and have offered to extract for UMC just that portion of the audio recording so that it can be timely published. The attorney for the board has agreed to notify the Office of Open Government on this Friday about when the recording will be posted. The UMC opinion was the subject of an article in the Washington Post on January 29th and was also a story on WTOP. So what we don't know, which is a bit confusing for Mr. Barton and I right now, is that we did receive a letter from the council to UMC on Monday. However, the letter was dated as being mailed on January 17th. So it appears to be a duplicate of a correspondence that was sent prior. So I've reached out to the attorney to find out what he intended with sending that letter, if it was just delayed in reaching the Office of Open Government. But we've received duplicate letters before. But to my knowledge, the UMC has not formally responded to the opinion. I was told briefly this morning, although I didn't have a chance to confirm it, that there is a press release or some statement on the UMC site responding to the opinion, but I wasn't able to find it.
Okay.
So regardless, I've reached out to counsel to get his input to find out whether or not there's been a formal reply. And, of course, if there is a formal reply, we'll also publish that on the website.
Okay. And from your previous conversations with him, did you get the impression that they had a problem with complying with posting just that portion of the closed session audio recording?
I made that offer yesterday, and he didn't specifically say one way or the other,
okay.
So I can't answer that. I don't have an impression one way or the other yet.
Okay. And on the website, I know we had an email exchange about how it was titled. I only see one opinion on the website.
There's only one opinion because it's a duplicate opinion.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And in the heading, you'll see on the landing page, it says opinions 0014 and 0015.
Right. Okay.
I just wanted to make it clear, which apparently I haven't, that it's a duplicate opinion.
I
So what I may end up doing is just listing it twice.
I understand. I have no idea if it's confusing for other people. I now understand it. I would suggest that you look at how you title the document versus the redactions you make within the document. In the document, you actually redact the complainant's information.
Yes.
Specifically the last name.
Yes.
The document title is based on the last name.
Oh, yes. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I understand. Are there any other questions about the UMC opinion? Okay. The Commission on Selection and Tenure, that was opinion OOG-0013. As required of all public bodies who violated the Open Meetings Act, the OOG required as part of the October 30, 2017 opinion issued to the Commission on the Selection and Tenure of Administrative Law Judges that the public body arrange for a training to be conducted by the Office of Open Government on the requirements of the Open Meetings Act. To date, the Office of Open Government has not heard from the chair of the COST, only from the Chief Administrative Law Judge Adams, who has declined to set a date for the COST to participate in an OOG training. He has instead expressed a preference to arrange a training with the Executive Office of the Mayor. 3 DCMR 10406.1 makes binding any corrective action advised. The regulatory requirement is in step with the two statutory provisions that require the Office of Open Government to exclusively conduct training for public body members. I'm sorry. Those statutes are DC Official Code 2-580, which requires the Office of Open Government to advise annually public bodies of the responsibilities under the Open Meetings Act. These trainings occur when primarily in conjunction with MOTA and the swearing-in of new public body members. DC Official Code 2-5933 requires the Office of Open Government to provide training to public bodies, officials, and employees related to the Open Meetings Act. The Office of Open Government reads DC Official Code 2-5933 in concert with DC Official Code 2-5932 to empower the Office of Open Government to conduct trainings in conjunction with noncompliance orders. The Office of Open Government has informed the COST of these requirements and has urged the public body to reconsider its position. I'm happy to re-engage the COST and make the request again upon the board's direction.
Have you had any communication since the last email that I saw? Because I didn't know that they had specifically identified EOM. I don't think that was in the email that I saw. So have you had additional communications? Because if you have, then they aren't the right ones to follow up with.
I have not had additional communications. I assumed it's the EOM because that's the only logical place.
Okay.
To request training on the Open Meetings Act.
Okay. Well, let me think about it. Let's talk more about it because it might be that we need to go to EOM and make sure we are on the same page that it is OOG that provides training.
I understand that MOTA is expressing a desire that only the Office of Open Government conduct the training. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
But I haven't talked to Betsy Cavendish or anyone else over there.
Okay.
So that might be. I want to make sure that Judge Adams is not getting guidance or that COST is not getting guidance contrary to the guidance that you provided them. And so I think we need to flesh that down before going back to him. I mean, you have a relationship with him. Obviously speak to him at will, but in terms of this being a global issue,
it's not. This is the only time that a public body has declined on the Office of Open Government's requirement pursuant to an advisory opinion that the Office of Open Government not conduct the training. This is the first time. So I would not characterize it as a global concern.
Okay.
This is a cost concern.
By all means, continue your communications with Judge Adams, but let me think about reaching out to EOM specifically about this matter and confirm that they don't have a different take on whose responsibility it is to provide the training.
Okay, that's fine. And then if you could also express to them that another reason that we require this is because it's the Office of Open Government that's been issuing advisory opinions on compliance with the Open Meetings Act. And only this office would be fully aware of what that guidance has been. So to the extent that questions are raised, this office is really in the best position to provide consistent formal advice.
Understood.
Okay. BEGA compliance with the Executive Office of the Mayor data policy. Madam Chair, I'm including this in my update because you and I chatted about this briefly. So I'm including this just to inform the body of what has occurred. On April 27, 2017, the mayor issued Order 2017-115, District of Columbia Data Policy. The policy was drafted by Interim Chief Technology Officer Barney Krukoff and the members of the mayor's Open Government Open Government Advisory Group, of which I am a member. The data policy requires that all agencies identify and categorize by security level all agency data sets and publish all low-level publicly available data online through OCTO's data portal. The data is classified according to accessibility, sensitivity, whether or not it contains personal identifying information, and sharing level, meaning the interagency or intra-agency. Wada Katab is the chief information officer assigned to work with OCTO to fulfill BEGA's obligations under the policy. He identified financial disclosure and lobbyist data to be structured public data with low-level sensitivity, excluding any PII. The data contained within ProLaw is categorized as strict high-level sensitive data and will not be shared. Additionally, the data contained within the OOG's data management system is categorized as low-level and will be shared, excluding PII. BEGA submitted its metadata data set approved by Agency General Counsel, Mr. Flowers. All of the requirements were met in August of this year.
Thank you.
You're welcome. FOIA and OMA advice. Since the last board meeting, the OOG has fielded advice requests for 9 FOIA and 3 OMA advice requests. Since the last meeting, the Office of Open Government received an Open Meetings Act complaint. I believe that was Tuesday evening, pertaining to the failure of the UMC board to provide an audio recording of a February 21st, 2017 UMC board meeting. And that concludes my update.
Thank you, and thank you for the notes. Getting back to the performance oversight responses, I did get a draft over the weekend of the actual responses. I apologize to you, Shamari and Norma, for not forwarding them on. I have asked Sandra to forward to all of us the most recent draft with the attachments, because I have not seen the attachments. I have a couple of some small questions, but nothing minor that would hold up actually sending the information. So if you two could take a look, and I'll ask Darren to do the same thing, and we'll get back to you with any comments. The plan is, like we are submitting the joint responses, that I will give the testimony for both the performance oversight and the budget hearings, obviously with input from the two of you. So I'll be in touch about the framework of the testimony and what information I need from the two of you.
So you'll be drafting the testimony?
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Reported by the Office of Government Ethics. Update on our operations during the last month. We opened 6 new investigations, didn't close any. We currently have 8 open investigations and 9 investigations have been stayed or in an active status. One of the investigations that's stayed is for a fugitive from justice situation. One is pending motions in front of the OEA. 5 are pending the resolution of investigations being conducted by the Office of the Inspector General. And 2 are being stayed pending False Claims Act cases that are being prosecuted by the Attorney General. Publication and reporting obligations. We have no outstanding publication or reporting obligations. Our quarterly complaint report will be published to the website early next week. Our agency performance measures were completed and uploaded into the City Administrator's QuickBase database. A copy of that report can be found on that website and was shared with the board previously. You will note by reference to the last column on pages 2 and 3 of that report that we met or exceeded all of our key performance indicator goals, including resolving more than 80% of our investigations by dismissal, negotiated disposition, or issuance of a notice of violation within 120 days of initiation. The report also reflects that we responded to 700 requests for informal ethics advice and received 183 complaints. We also conducted 129 trainings during the last fiscal year.
Excellent. Going back to the, I think it was 81 or 84% for the timely resolution of the complaints. I know OCTO was a reason, one reason for us not having 100%. Have we identified any other reasons? Do we need to make some changes to push that up a little higher?
To be quite honest, I believe the timeline is a lofty goal, but I believe the more in-depth investigations that we anticipate opening will probably require more time to complete, because when you are sending out requests for data from providers like Uber or Facebook, you know, this digital evidence that is required to really get to the heart of our investigations, it takes longer to get that information back and evaluated. So while I should say, cautiously optimistic that we will be able to continue meeting this 120-day goal, I do want the board to be aware that there may very well be circumstances and individual investigations that would make it impossible for us to do so. Okay. Regarding trainings and outreach that have been conducted by our staff over the last month, we verified through PeopleSoft yesterday that all Vega staff have completed the online training course, Sexual Harassment Prevention for Employees, as outlined in Mayor's Order 2017-313, dated December 19, 2017. We also conducted 11 training sessions, considerably more than the two before our prior meeting, which bridged the holiday period. Those trainings consisted of two new employee orientations, two MSS FDS presentations, two board and commission trainings, two OAG Hatch Act trainings, one Department of Insurance Securities and Banking Hatch Act training, and an ethics training program conducted for LEAP, which is the Learn, Earn, Advance, and Prosper program, the participants at DOES in that program. Regarding advisory opinions and advice, we have provided approximately 100 responses to requests for informal advice, including approximately 28 related to the lobbyist filing deadline 2 weeks ago, which is well up from the 20 reported at the last meeting.
If only 28 involved the lobbyists, what's with the influx in informal opinions? What's the subject matter of the request for informal opinions?
They run the gamut. We have received a lot of Hatch Act requests, though. We actually have received a lot of those. And then the outside employment requests. I guess people are just back from vacation, back from holidays, so they're asking questions again.
Okay.
Any other questions?
I've never seen that number be that high before. I mean, that's substantial.
Yep.
For 1 month.
Yep. It may be something we want to take a look at to see if there were any additional factors that we could identify that would maybe partially explain the increase. But, you know, it's like Brian says, sometimes these things run in cycles and there's no real explanation for it.
Right. I mean, if it is clustered around certain issues, it may be an indication that we need to develop a training for those particular issues. If you're going to move on from there, I do have one question about training. We had spoken previously about community-based training. Have we moved forward at all with that?
Yes, I had some communications with Ashley Cook, our attorney who takes the lead in our training initiatives, and she had identified one potential venue for the Vega Road Show, so to speak, I don't know when she's planning on doing that. Ashley, do you have any concrete plans on when you are going to do that?
Possibly within next year.
Okay.
And I anticipate working closely with the OIG to try to organize maybe joint appearances at some of the local community organizations, because I know in my former life we did that. And because our missions are so similar, I think that it would be beneficial to have that community outreach to explain clearly the distinction between the two agencies, and also to kind of just have a catalyst for forward momentum and actually engaging the community on our missions.
Okay. And consider whether OOG should be a part of some of those as well.
Absolutely. I think all three agencies are related to, you know, transparency of government operations and keeping government honest. So I think that it would make sense for all three entities to participate. Formal advice request. We have one pending request for a formal advisory opinion. The subject matter of that opinion is permissible activities involving hosting quote-unquote meet and greets, not fundraisers, for partisan political candidates under the District of Columbia Hatch Act, ethics laws, or election expenditures laws. And the individual who requested that formal opinion also sent that request to the Office of Campaign Finance. Ethics legislation, comprehensive code of conduct. We are not aware of any recent developments with respect to ethics legislation or the CCC. OGE staff met with staff from Councilmember Todd's office concerning proposed lobbying legislation that might be included in the CCC. And I met with Councilmember Allen on January 23rd, 2018, and discussed several issues, including both the CCC and my personal opinion that legislative changes were desirable to clarify OGE's authority to apply for search warrants to obtain evidence in the course of our investigations. So that's, again, I'm clarified that was my personal opinion as well. I was not speaking on behalf of the board.
Okay. We need to, I don't think we're going to have time today, but we need to sit down and flesh out some of that and the implications.
Absolutely. Rulemaking, we have nothing new to report on rulemaking. Budget, as Director Hughes indicated, our performance oversight hearing is scheduled for Thursday, February 8th. And we have continued to hold monthly budget meetings with OCFO. Staffing, we have three administrative positions to fill. I'm leaning towards restructuring OGE's organizational chart and utilizing a slightly different staffing model that I think will improve our efficiency and better position OGE to accomplish its assigned mission. Lobbyists, financial disclosure matters. Regarding the public financial disclosure statements, we are still working to ensure that all non-compliant public financial disclosure statement filers file their forms via our e-filing system. We will soon begin the early stages of preparation for the 2018 financial disclosure season. Regarding confidential financial disclosure statements for calendar year 2017, as you guys may know, the employee who previously maintained our CFDS non-filer list is no longer with the agency. We're in the process of reviewing CFDS reports and following up with agency ethics officers. We will soon compile a list of CFDS non-filers and begin the enforcement process. Lobbyists. We just finished a very busy January lobbyist filing season, which included this office's staff responding to numerous inquiries. As you are aware, lobbyist registrations for the 2018 calendar year were due January 16th, and lobbyist activity reports covering the second half of 2017 were due January 10th. To date, 287 registration forms have been filed for 2018, which is up slightly from the 275 registrations that were filed at this time last year. In addition, approximately 378 lobbyist activity reports were filed in January of 2018, which is a small increase from 371 last year, and there were 72 termination reports filed, which is an increase of exactly one from last year, so that stayed pretty steady.
Do we have a plan for what percentage do we actually audit?
To be quite honest, I don't know what the specific percentages that we audit. We're working to come up with more formal procedures to describe the initiation of an audit, the random selection of the audits, whether there are any factors that need to be taken into consideration that would make auditing a particular filer not necessarily random. There's a red flag that would be identified just through an examination of the data. And once we get those policies and procedures in place, that will also involve establishing what percentage would constitute an accurate representation of the entire universe. And I'll work with the rest of our staff and Ishmael, our auditor, to make sure that our policies and procedures are in accordance with generally accepted auditing standards. Next item on my report is non-confidential investigations. First one is number 1641001, Henry R. French. At the last meeting, it was decided that we would proceed to sanction Mr. French using the director's authority to impose ministerial fines. Mr. French will be provided an opportunity to address the board at its March meeting regarding that process. We're putting a new process into place to try to provide more clear due process protections for folks that are subject to the ministerial fines. We have decided, and this is governing the next case we want to talk about, the Rochelle Wilson case, that our intention is to establish a procedure where we will send notice of a notice to show good cause why a proposed ministerial fine should not be imposed. Give the filer a certain period of days to submit argument or evidence why the proposed fine should not be imposed. Then take that evidence and argument into consideration, issue a written ministerial fine order, and provide them with a certain number of days to appeal it to the board, which I think is already in the regulations. So we anticipate having two such notice of good cause and ministerial fines issued in the next month in Mr. French's case and number 1634-001 regarding Rochelle Wilson.
Do you need to amend your regulations to make the change for the notice process?
We don't believe so. Brian and I talked about it yesterday. I think that it's maybe sometime down the road we will want to do that, but I think we have the power to adopt this new policy independently.
Yeah, we're reviewing that.
Okay.
And we did look to the Office of Campaign Finance as a model because this is type the sort of process that they follow, and we'll be issuing a notice of a notice to show good cause to both of those folks in the next week or so.
As you are formalizing this process, specifically as it relates to failure to file financial disclosures, I invite you to also take a look at the guidance that you give the individuals on the page where they file. What could be potentially confusing is you identify the late fee up to, I think it's $300. And some people may be under the mistaken belief that $300 is the max that they would ever be responsible for. So take a look at how you are notifying the public of potential risk for late filing or failing to file at all.
Makes sense. Thank you. Okay, and the third non-confidential investigation is number 1398-001 in regarding Courtney Snowden. This is an investigation referred by the Office of the Inspector General involving the Deputy Mayor for Greater Economic Opportunity. According to the OIG's report of investigation, on three occasions in late summer 2015, Ms. Snowden used government resources for other than official business and ordered, directed, or requested subordinate employees to perform personal services in violation of DPM sections 1807.1B and 1807.1C. We have been in communications with Ms. Snowden's attorney.
All right, that's it for you?
That's it for me.
Okay, we will move to the public comment portion. Yes. Do you want to, can we make space for her to come up?
Oh, come on.
Okay.
Good morning, Ms. Brazil.
Good morning. My name is Dorothy Brazil, D-R-I-Z-I-L-L.
Resident. My name is Dorothy Brazil. I'm a resident and voter in the District of Columbia. I come to you today. I had hoped to have something written out, but I will submit something to your staff by the close of business today. And it goes back to essentially an issue I've raised in the past, and they're namely two. Number one, the Vegas website. It is still not functioning. It is still not providing the information that the public needs, and it is still problematic. I don't know, and I submitted to Mr. Flowers' somewhat detailed memo as regards some of the shortcomings or problems I encountered several months ago, and I don't know why nothing is being done. But today specifically, I'm coming to you with a very specific issue that I think highlights my concerns regarding not only the website, but I think the performance of Vega. Bear with me for a moment. Next Monday, the council is scheduled to have a hearing to confirm an individual by the name of Chris Geldart, the district's former director of the Office of Homeland Security, to a position on the newly established Washington Metro Rail Safety Commission. He is being appointed by the mayor to fill one of the seats on that commission. I knew from anecdotal stories that had been told to me by staff at the Office of Homeland Security that there were numerous problems with regard to Mr. Geldhart's tenure over there. And then I knew that he very suddenly departed from his position sometime the beginning of last year. So with that, I went on a search and was told that Vega had done an investigation and had a complaint referred to it regarding Mr. Geldhart. Of course, my first thing was to go on the Vega website and put Chris Geldhart's name in. Nothing came up. I then did an internet Google search, and I found out that, in fact, there had been an investigation done of Mr. Geldhart, but not by Vega, but by the Office of the Inspector General. Now, this is where it gets troublesome for me. On the OIG's website, which anybody can go to, there is a activity report of an investigation the OIG concluded on August 31, 2017. And I have a copy of the first and last page of that for you. In that report of investigation, it indicates that there were three complaints that had been brought to the Office of the Inspector General through a referral by Vega. The referral was made by Vega on June 2nd, 2015. I stress, June 2nd, 2015. The OIG issued its report on August 31st, 2017, last year. So for 2 years, this matter sat as a matter of investigation by OIG. I thought that was rather curious. When I went a little bit further, I was concerned because the last paragraph of the OIG's report indicates that he is referring the matter back to Vega for Vega to take action. So in preparation for next Monday's hearing, I tried to find out, number one, why was there this long time span, this gap? And I will say, if you read the full investigation, there were not any difficult issues to be investigated. It wasn't as if you had to go to the FBI or engage a detective to do any investigation. It's whether or not he violated certain contracting issues, whether or not he used his government vehicle for his own personal use in the state of Virginia, where he actually did live. So not being able to find out why there was this gap of 2 years and not being able to find out what the disposition of the matter was after the matter was referred to back to Vega by the OIG. I then had a conversation with Mr. Flowers yesterday, and Mr. Flowers informed me, oh, that matter has been dismissed. Again, I went on the Vega website. No order of dismissal was there. Not yesterday, not when I looked for it. An order of dismissal was finally posted on Vega's website sometime late yesterday. Now, I know this is all disjointed and people who don't have the paperwork in front of them can't figure out what I'm really saying, but let me just say this. You have the head of an agency against whom 3 substantial complaints and charges were brought by several staff people over there. And if any of you have worked in D.C. government, you know it's not easy to roll up your sleeves and file a complaint against your boss. Vega thought enough of it to refer it to the OIG in 2015. The OIG takes 2 years to complete an investigation, issues an investigation, the findings of its investigation, in which it upholds 2 of the 3 charges and issues that report in the letter I have to the council on August 31st, 2017. But then Mr. Flowers was nice enough to send me the paperwork in which the actual order that this board signed dismissing the complaint. And that order is dated July. So I'm saying, wait a minute. The OIG's report came out in August, and this board issued a dismissal order in July. I don't know what this is all about. I really don't. I really, really don't. But I think there's 2 larger issues that I think, and I'm putting it before the board. I will put it before the council at your performance hearing. I will put it before the council at your budget hearing. Number one, I think it's a travesty for you to have a component of your organization be the open government office, and you can't even have a decent website. You have all this equipment that I was led to believe was taping the meetings. But guess what? You don't have the ability to post your meetings, and you don't regularly post your minutes. There's only 1 set of minutes up there on your website, and that's for November of last year. And I assume you only put that up there because I came to the October meeting and complained. So, first and foremost, the website. And more than lip service to openness and transparency. Second of all, at some point before Monday, I need someone to sit down and explain to me this discrepancy in dates. But the third thing that to me is a larger issue is there is nowhere on your website anything that tells people what the processes and procedure is. Now, after being around D.C. government a little while, you know, you get an intuitive sense and your little suspicious genes kick in. And I will tell you what my suspicious gene told me this morning when I saw, oh, miraculously, this order of dismissal from Vega is up there. Geldar is trying to clean up his act, clean up any public record before Monday's hearing. And for whatever reason, Vega is complicit in that. Now, in the order of dismissal, it's essentially 1 page. It just says, in July, Vega dismissed it because you didn't believe there was reasonable proof of a violation of ethics laws. that's 180 degrees different from the OIG's report, which states that they have more than substantial evidence to prove at least two of the charges of ethics violations are provable. So, to summarize, number one, please, please, please do something about your website. Not only isn't the information there, but you cannot search it. I don't doubt that the staff will say, oh, it's there, it's there, there. They have access to a database and probably know the tricks of the website that the general public shouldn't know, doesn't know. But we should not be needing of the tricks of the website. The second thing I ask you is to direct me to whom is going to be able to explain the Chris Gelthart situation. And I use the Chris Gelthart situation, just like the Michael Brown situation a few months ago, for someone to explain to me, how do you do business down here? And the third thing is, I urge you, just like the website, you need to put on your website something that is readable and understandable as regards the process and procedures down here. I don't know how the board comes to decide on a negotiated disposition. All of a sudden, the Kaya Henderson is a negotiated disposition. I don't know why you issue order of dismissal, because there's no argument, no reasoning. I don't know when you decide to go to a hearing. There is nothing on your website that I can find. Maybe someone needs to direct me to it. When you impose a fine, you dismiss, you go to negotiated disposition or what have you. And I say all of this because I was in the room, the multiple rooms, the multiple days in which the legislation that created this office, this department was negotiated. I would like to see you succeed, but you've got to be able to cross that threshold in terms of people being able to trust you. I think that this Gelthart thing points out to what's going on here, and I intend to shine a spotlight on it. So with that, I didn't mean to belabor this so much, but I think I do my homework, and I am more than pissed. I am more than pissed if this is the way the bank is doing business, because this is not the first time. This is not the first time. I think there's been different strokes with different folks.
Thank you, Ms. Mazzil. Director Wolfenbarger, do you want to address either of the issues?
I'll address some, and I'll have Mr. Flowers address some. The Gelthart situation occurred before I was here, so I have limited knowledge of the specific facts that led to the decision to dismiss those charges. I've read a summary of it, but I would definitely defer to Mr. Flowers regarding the specific nature.
Right. The issue with Gelthart is it wasn't a public investigation.
Right.
He gave authority to release the notice of dismissal. But Mr. Flowers, can you expound on that?
I think that just sums it up. We couldn't publish anything until he consented in writing to the release of the information. It was confidential when it came to us, confidential when we referred it, confidential when it came back.
I don't understand what these two gentlemen have just said. Let me tell you, my reference point is as regards issues and complaints before the Office of Campaign Finance, the Office of Board of Elections, to some extent, the OIG. Once the OIG issued his report and didn't just send it here to Bega, sent it to the council, the secretary of the council, for her to distribute to other council members in August. I don't understand why there's any issue of secrecy. Moreover, I have a fundamental ingrained reaction to a lot of things that Baker is saying, oh, it's secret, and this convoluted idea that you can redact names. You pointed out a decision regarding United Medical Center, in which in one place they redact a name, in another place they don't redact it. You can go through all your documents, and they're just like that. So is there secrecy or there isn't secrecy? And secrecy for who? Secrecy for who? You know, my thing would be, if a complaint comes to Vega, just like other agencies, and it's not, you know, crazy, or it's not unsubstantiated, what have you, then that should be something that can be known to the public, as well as all the steps in along the way to do an investigation, to prove or disprove or what have you. But am I led to believe by Mr. Flowers that Mr. Gelthardt had to give his approval for the publication of the order of dismissal? Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. Do you want to?
Where is that in the DCMR?
It's in chapter 50, 51, 52, 52, 58. It's one of those.
What?
I'd have to look. Well, actually, this is in the Ethics Act. It's not in the DCMR.
And what does it say?
I don't have it in front of me. I can certainly provide it to you.
But you have to implement whatever it says. So just tell me, I'm not going to hold you verbatim to the wording. Are you saying that?
It says the identity of the subject of an investigation shall not be disclosed unless they consent. And he was the subject of the investigation.
Do you know if the Office of Inspector General has that same standing?
That I do not know. They certainly have a different statute. Have any idea?
You were at the Office of IG. What is your knowledge?
I do not know that the specifics regarding their disclosure obligations. I worked in the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, so I wasn't involved in the investigations division's work. But I believe the distinction in Vega's legislation is that unless the board votes to make a formal investigation, it remains a confidential investigation. And as I said, I wasn't here when this occurred last summer, but it would be my deduction that the board never voted to make it a formal investigation, that OGE staff decided that the evidence warranted dismissal rather than presenting it to the board. Is that a fair assumption?
Wasn't made public. I mean, the problem is anyone can file a complaint, and that really has the ability to disparage someone's character. That's the reason these investigations remain confidential unless there's a reason to make them public.
As I said already, I understand that. And I've been around a few investigations and have caused a few investigations to be made of impropriety. But let me just say this.
Well, just one example, Snowden, in a similar posture, came here from the OIG board, has made that public. That's a public investigation. So that two different investigations that came here in the same manner, but one was made public, one was not.
And the Snowden one was made public because?
Because the board decided that it would be made public.
And why did the board decide that the Snowden investigation is public and the Gelthardt one would be kept secret?
Well, the two investigations are different, but the information presented to us and the recommendation from the staff for the two after their preliminary investigation was different.
But someone pointed out to me the OIG investigation was not public when we received it. The Snowden investigation was.
Well, but see, this is the other thing that someone has got to get a clarification on. The OIG investigation, and I have the date of August 31st, 2017, both in terms of his letter to the council and his posting on his own website when he completed the investigation, shows that it was completed in August of 2017. Your dismissal order is dated July 2017. So when did you get the OIG report?
We received it prior to July, several months prior to that.
Well, someone, there's some funny business here. I mean, it doesn't make it. Why would, never mind. Can I ask the board, do you have a policy? What is the policy in terms of when you decide to make something public, when you decide to not make it public, do you have some guidelines or standards?
Yeah, the standard.
How do you, and my other thing is, the order of dismissal on Mr. Gelthardt is essentially, I think, operative for three sentences. There's no indication of why you decided to dismiss it, especially given the fact that we have a top public document from the OIG, which says there's substantial evidence, and all you say that insufficient evidence exists to support a reasonable belief that a violation occurred. I mean, if nothing else, wouldn't you want to elaborate on that? Because on the one hand, you have this six-page document that details the OIG's investigation, and you have six words that say you don't believe there's reasonable evidence. I mean, I just don't understand this. And
our
I'm only using this as one example.
Sure. And there is on its face a conflict, but the two offices use two different standards. Vega OGE actually has to prove the allegations in a proceeding. So their level of proof is higher than what the OIG is using. One, two, our investigators conduct their own investigation. So when a complaint comes in, the subject of that complaint is kept confidential. They do preliminary investigations, and then they make recommendations to the board whether notices of violations should be issued. If a notice of violation is not issued, then that complaint never becomes public. Part of due process rights for the subject of the complaint. If a notice of violation is issued, then the board can vote whether or not to make the notice of violation public. And we generally will do that unless making public will somehow jeopardize the continued investigation. So in the Gelthardt matter, the staff determined and the board agreed that there was insufficient evidence to move forward, sufficient that they would likely be able to prove a violation if it actually went to a contested hearing.
On the Gelthardt matter, and again, only using this as one current example, did you have a written report from Vega's investigators as regards their belief that there was insufficient evidence, or did you just receive an oral presentation during closed-door session?
I received an oral presentation.
And I'm looking at the organizational chart for Vega. You have a total of two investigators on your organizational chart. I think the last time I checked, the Office of Inspector General has substantially more resources in terms of investigators, and their conclusion was that there was substantial evidence. I guess my concern is where do we go from here? Let me deal with the low-hanging fruit. Can I get a commitment from the board that you will do something about your website?
Do you have an update on the website?
Yeah, we've been working with Octo to get those problems resolved. We've put a priority on getting the new e-filing systems operational.
The new what?
E-filing systems. For the financial disclosure statements and the lobbyist reports, that has not been an optimal process, to say the least. But I did read your complaints, Mr. Brazil, and I thought that they were very on point and accurate. My experience with the website mirrored yours, and I agree that if we cannot provide the public with a way to search the information they need, we are not accomplishing what we were intended to do. And part of the new e-filing system and the lobbyist reports are going to involve a public-facing portal so that members of the public will be able to download that information directly from the system, as opposed to waiting for us to publish things. So the guidance that we have given OCTO is to be able to generate reports searchable by agency, by year, by person, and export it directly from the system.
Okay. I appreciate your answer, but let me just say this. Any holding up the website improvement to the point in which you can make improvements in the e-filing, we'll be here next year talking about this. Okay? What I am talking about and what I don't understand and no one can explain to me is why basic information about issues and decisions and actions taken by Vega in the past or being considered by Vega right now can't be posted on their website. Okay? I'm not talking about e-filing. I'm not talking about lobbyist reports. I'm not talking about any of that. Okay? I'm not talking about augmenting the system with bells and whistles. I don't understand it. Okay? And it's not only the information isn't there, or if it is there, it's so convoluted you cannot find it. And you have a search function that will not search for anything. I went and searched for cases I knew you had decided, put in names I knew you had decided, and nothing comes up. That is unacceptable. And you should be ashamed of yourself to have the Office of Open Government sitting here. And guess what? You can't get any information out of it. But I would like to leave here with one thing, with a couple of things. Number one, that you will make a commitment, not in the distant future, to do something about your website. Second of all, I want someone to explain to me the Gelthardt situation, because I think the Gelthardt situation is endemic and goes to the heart of whether or not this board is going to continue to be relevant. Because I see you impose fines, I see you take actions, I see you force individuals to get attorneys and come to hearings and what have you, and then through paperwork, the Gelthardt thing just goes away. And guess what? It goes away a week before you have to appear before the council, okay? And I have, on the one hand, what I think is a substantial document by the OIG that tells me and corroborates what I've been hearing from the staff for over 2 years about what was going on over there. And I have 6 words in this dismissal order. So I would like to sit down with Mr. Flowers or whoever and get someone to explain to me how you made a decision on the Gelthardt situation. And three, I urge the board, if you want to maintain relevance, if you want to maintain credibility, if you do not want the appearance that different strokes for different folks, you have got to publish how you do business. I mean, it's no surprise, and I'm not a great fan of how the Board of Elections conducts its business. But if I wanted to know, if someone came, stopped me in the hallway and said, I am challenging a petition before the Board of Elections, what is the process and procedure? I can point them to the D.C. Code, the D.C. Municipal Regulations, and the board publishes their past cases and the rationales, the decisions in those cases. So you can look at them and say, okay, the threshold for my case is this, based upon past actions by the board. You can't do that with this. It's a free-for-all. And it's a free-for-all that I'm concerned is benefiting only certain people.
Thank you for your comments, Ms. Brazil. Mr. Flowers, can you work with her to address some of her specific concerns about the process?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Who have any other comments?
Good morning to the members of the board. I promise to be brief.
Good morning,
Mary B. My name is Paula Gibbs. I'm a Ward 4 DC resident and a DC native, and I'm also an agency FOIA officer. And I'm present at this meeting to express my sincere support for Tracy Hughes as the director of the Office of Open Government. Okay. I was brought on board as the agency FOIA officer in August of 2017. And the first piece of advice that I received from my supervisor was, ask Tracy. And she was absolutely correct. I had no idea about the asset I had in Ms. Hughes, but from my day one, she proved to be the most resourceful, knowledgeable, and of most importance to me, approachable and accessible resource outside of the agency. She has approached each issue and question that I've had with focused deliberation and has never left me without an answer. She is patient, she is kind, and she is a hard worker who will continue to make DC's open government program a model for other cities to emulate. I appreciate everything she has done for me personally in my growth as a FOIA officer and as an attorney, and for the guidance she provides to my agency. I sincerely hope and pray that I can continue to work with her in the future.
Thank you, Ms. Gibbs. Any other public comments? All right, at this time, I will entertain a motion to move into executive session to discuss ongoing confidential investigations pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-57B to deliberate on a decision in which the Ethics Board will exercise quasi-judicial functions pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-57B13. And to deliberate on the appointment, employment, assignment, promotion, performance evaluation, compensation, discipline, removal, and resignation of government appointees and employees pursuant to DC Official Code Section 2-575B10.
I move that we go into executive session to discuss the matters you've enumerated.
Second.
All in favor? Aye. Any opposed? All right, the time is now 11:08. We'll be in executive session.
All right, the time is now 1:15, and we're back on public record. The board has one matter to report out. The board has voted unanimously to not reappoint Tracy as the director of the Office of Government. Our next meeting date will be March 8th.